Hudson Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From the home of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news, talk, and sports station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. New details emerging in New Mexico about a defeated GOP candidate accused of targeting the homes of four Democratic state officials. CBS's Steve Futterman has more on the story.
Investigators say Solomon Pena hired people to shoot at the homes of two county commissioners and a pair of New Mexico state senators. Kyle Hartzik is with the Albuquerque Police Department.
The evidence that we have is not only firearm, but it's also from cell phones and electronic records, surveillance video.
Police say in one of the attacks, Pena went along with the shooters and attempted to fire a gun himself, but it malfunctioned. Pena has a criminal record. He spent 5 years in prison. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
A $10,000 reward is being offered for information leading to the arrest of two suspects wanted in yesterday's massacre in a Central California home. Among the victims, a 16-year-old mother and her 10-month-old baby. KGPE-TV's Esteban Reynoso reports.
The sheriff says the home in Goshen is well known to law enforcement. A narcotics search warrant was conducted earlier this month, and drugs and guns were found inside.
Not all these people in this home are gang members. Definitely this 10-month-old child is an innocent victim.
Sheriff Boudreaux says the investigation has already taken them outside of Tulare County.
Make no mistake, I'm not saying that this is a cartel, but also be clear that I am not eliminating that possibility.
In California, the rain has finally stopped, but some residents of Ocampo remain under a mandatory evacuation order as floodwater spreads. This woman is one of them.
This is definitely horrific for us. There's nowhere for the water to go, so we're screwed at this point.
President Biden heads to California on Thursday to see the damage. A Massachusetts man, Brian Walsh, has been charged with the murder of his wife, who has been missing since New Year's Day. CBS's Nancy Chen with more.
Investigators tell our CBS Boston station WBZ that their search of a nearby waste facility turned up trash cans with blood, a hatchet, a hacksaw, and a rug. Prosecutors say Walsh was also caught on tape purchasing $450 worth of cleaning supplies.
A Russian mercenary seeks asylum in Norway. CBS's Vicky Barker has more from our foreign desk.
Andrei Medvedev says he deserted from the notorious Wagner mercenary group in Ukraine and crossed from Russia into Norway on foot, seeking asylum there. He says he's willing to collaborate with international investigators probing possible war crimes in Ukraine.
Actor Jeremy Renner says he's home from the hospital after being treated for serious injuries from a snowplow accident. Renner was run over by his own plow in Nevada while trying to use it to free a relative's vehicle on a private road near Lake Tahoe. That was on New Year's Day. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
Attention all business owners who rent or lease space, including storage space. Stop wasting your money paying someone else for your space. You can now save a ton of money and own your own building with unbelievable extended end-of-year sale prices from General Steel. That's right. Start saving money every month on renting space from others. Just call 888-74-STEEL to see how General Steel can help you save money. Our 50-year structural warranty buildings are custom designed for your needs and save you a ton of money. Call 888-74-STEEL. Steel.
Take it from a successful entrepreneur. If you need to expand or start a new business, you need General Steel.
Great team and the competitive pricing is the reason I went with General Steel.
Call 888-74-STEEL now, and you can get any of our popular quick construction structures, including a 40 by 60 foot building or a 50 by 100 clear span building. Act fast, because for a limited time only, General Steel is extending its end of year savings. Call 888-74-STEEL. That's 888-747-8335. 888-74-STEEL.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about, but you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
For Civic Media, I'm Melissa Kay with your local news update. Following is a list of upcoming meetings in the listening area for Wednesday, January 18th. In Wood County, the Criminal Justice Task Force will meet at 12 p.m. at the courthouse in Wisconsin Rapids in room 115. The Local Emergency Planning Committee will meet at 1 p.m. at the Wood County EOC in the courthouse. The McMillan Memorial Library Board of Trustees will meet at 5 p.m. in the McCourt Conference Room of the Library in Wisconsin Rapids. In Portage County, the Public Safety Emergency Management Committee will meet at 8 a.m. at the Portage County LEC Training Room. The PCHCC committee meeting will take place at 5 p.m. In Adams County, the Housing Authority will meet from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. at 350 East Liberty Street in Adams. The Arctic Run Model Railroad Show and Sales will hold their annual show on January 21st and 22nd at the Holiday Inn Convention Center in Stevens Point. And that's the news update on your locally grown radio station.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A winter storm watch begins at midnight Thursday morning and continues until 6 p.m. Thursday night. 26 overnight under overcast skies, northwesterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Highs level off around 33, tomorrow cloudy skies. Snow likely, tomorrow night 27, cloudy. 4 to 8 inches of snow tomorrow night through Thursday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently it's 34.
From Alexander Field to the Central Business District, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today on your lunch hour. As always, you can join the conversation at 844-967-2789. And so it's not breaking news that Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And for some people, they know how it got that way. But for a lot of us, it's kind of this just it is. But in reality, it became that way by design. And so two University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee professors are leading an effort to document and map what shaped the racial geography of not only just the city, but Milwaukee County in a project called Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County. So here today to help us talk about the project are those two professors, Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds. Derek is an assistant professor in the English Department of Public Rhetoric and Community Engagement at UWM. And Ann Bonds is an associate professor and associate chair of geography and an affiliate faculty member of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So let's just start, because I think sometimes people come to this conversation around segregation in Milwaukee. And it's not just a story of Milwaukee. I mean, I think Chicago, you see Chicago and Detroit and so many other large metropolitan areas. I think a lot that during the last century, like a century ago, kind of how they forced people to live in certain neighborhoods. And so the tactic I'm more familiar with is redlining. So for people who don't know what redlining is, could either of you explain that?
There's been a great deal of interest in redlining, and it's really wonderful that everybody's learning more about this. Redlining maps come from an institution, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, established by the federal government following the Depression, really to try to stabilize housing prices. And the Homeowners Loan Corporation was tasked with essentially mapping over 200 cities and their kind of real estate markets to identify places where it would be safe to invest and areas that would be, as they were termed, risky for investment. So it was really, these maps were used, they kind of graded neighborhoods or areas of the city. And so redlined areas are called such because they were colored red on these maps. And these were places that were marked as risky or not safe for financial lending, and essentially barring whole neighborhoods or portions of cities from mortgage lending. And so certainly redlining had a powerful effect on segregation. But what we're here to talk with you about today is racial covenants, which actually existed before these maps were made, and they were being utilized. And in fact, sometimes the redlining maps were drawn around areas with covenants.
So that was what, and in learning about the project, I've heard of like the handshake deals that was kind of like the implicit like understanding of who you sold your house to. But when reading more about the project, it was the first time I've even heard this term covenant. So can you tell you more about what those were and how prevalent and prominent they were in Milwaukee County?
Sure. Covenants are just clauses that are inserted into property deeds, and they stipulate how a property can be used, how what the appearance should look like of properties, even the value of properties. So when you get into these covenants, you're reading things about garage setbacks, for example, or the building heights that are required, or the stipulations for building heights in neighborhoods. And what also is included in here, up until, you know, they were made illegal, were racial covenants, which explicitly stated that certain groups were not allowed to live in certain areas. And they are actually quite extensive and detailed, often in terms of their legality. There'll be long stipulations in these covenants about, nobody can live here, but also after you sell the house, even the successors or heirs to this property can't sell. So they're very explicit in barring people of color, especially African Americans, from neighborhoods.
And even though they're illegal, some of this language is still present today in people's in deeds, their housing deeds. There was a person who told me from Madison when her and her husband bought the house, they were reading, one of the few people who actually read all of
the fine print,
right.
The terms of service.
Right. And they came across this and said, hey, what's this? So it's, even though it, like I said, even though it's out, it's illegal in some places, it's still in their deeds.
And so the fact that it's still in the deeds in some places, is that just because people don't read the fine print and it just it continues to exist? Or is there people who are still complicit and just trying to get away with it?
They're not functional, so they don't serve the purpose that they were designed to initially.
Okay.
So they can't be used, but they certainly have a symbolic power. They tell you about the history of a neighborhood, how it was formed, who was excluded. They're written into the deed. Oftentimes, these were meant to run with the land. It's often stated, which means that it runs with the property. And so they're just included in that legalese language. And so, yeah, you know, this people's interest in this project means that a lot of folks have gone out and gone to look at their own property records and see what they can find. And they're finding that, yes, in fact, there were racial covenants, there was a racial covenant attached to their property, and they didn't know about it because it's buried in, you know, all of these documents. And you can access the original property record for any property at the Register of Deeds office. And, you know, they can help you find it. It's somewhat difficult or it can take some time. You definitely need the support of the people in the office. And you can see your original property record, and that's where you would find these kinds of details.
So the project, from what I understand, seems kind of like a Herculean task of what you both are set out to do with the help of a lot of volunteers. So tell me more and tell the audience more about what the project is.
Well, I think I'm going to let Anne talk a little bit more because she began this process.
Okay.
Early on, she was going to the deeds register's office and kind of looking these up one at hand. So I'll let you share the story, and then I'll share when I jump in.
Sounds good. I'm interested in segregation and race, and I always, as a geographer, feel like maps are a really powerful way to help us see the way that social dynamics become embedded or connected to certain places. And so I teach a class called The Geography of Race, and I had seen a couple of examples where people had made these interfaces to show the history of segregation. And I was interested in doing this myself, kind of thinking about the way that all of these things kind of overlapped and created these various boundaries in the city for people of color. And, you know, the redlining itself, how did the redlining maps and the Hulk map for Milwaukee from 1938 connect to these other dynamics? And so I started digging into covenants, and I knew they existed. There's a great report written by Lois Quinn from 1979, which cataloged some of these. And so, of course, we're grateful for her work. But there's nothing exhaustive because it's very difficult. And we're talking, of course, about thousands and thousands and thousands of documents. So it is a Herculean effort in that respect. And so somewhere along the line, as I was, you know, one semester, I always tell the story because it kind of gives you a sense that, you know, my research assistant and I were combing through records. And one semester, we were really excited because we found about 50 that hadn't been documented before, which was great. But, you know, when we're talking about thousands and thousands of racially restrictive covenants that likely exist, we knew that this was going to be something that would take years and years and years.
Yeah.
And then I met some colleagues at the University of Minnesota. They had a project called Mapping Prejudice, and they're now people that we collaborate with. And they had this really innovative way of doing the project where they got digitized copies of the property records. And so what we've done the same thing. And then they run this through software, an optical character recognition software, and they're actually flagging certain terminology using scripts, but to flag language. So we know that Caucasian is a word, Caucasians only, whites. We see the language, apologies in advance to listeners for offensive language. We see terms like colored people. We see terms like African. We see through all of their research and support of their own project, our project, they become experts on these, and they've helped us kind of put together a set of words to flag. And so from that then, so we initially started with 1.7 million images.
Oh my God.
And we took those images were converted to text, they're run through the software, and now we have a core data set of about 21,000 records. And so we're going through those records now with volunteers, which is the important part of the process. We're working together with volunteers to look at those deeds and say, yes, do they have a covenant, or no, do they have a covenant?
Yeah.
Because machines aren't humans and they make mistakes. And so there are certain things that could be flagged that could be like racial language that might be flagged. And it turns out, nope, they're not actually covenants. So that's the process we're in right now, is working through those covenants with volunteers.
Got it. So we're talking to UWM professors Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds about their Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County project. And so I think it's interesting because a geography professor and a English professor walk into a bar. It's like the beginning of a joke. And so quickly, we'll come back and talk more about the project and the importance of it and what it can accomplish by the volunteers and really being able to map this. But as far as the two disciplines and how they overlap for this project, how did they... Because I think people tend to think literature and English sits over here and geography and urban studies sits over here. And so how do you two see the two disciplines working together on this project?
Well, so this is where I come into the story. So when I first came to UWM, I was familiar with Anne's work. And so I reached out to her just to talk about her work, and because there was an article that she had wrote that I found very interesting. And we met and we talked, and she first mentioned this project that she was doing. I think this was early in 2020. So it was in the back of my hand and back of my head. And then, of course, as we know, the summer of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, and there was this awakening. My own work, I look at the ways in which African-American communities respond to urban renewal in the 50s and 60s. So I'm very interested in Black organizing. I am in English department, but my work is interdisciplinary. And so I remember her project, and I reached out to her and to see where it was. And we met and we discussed, and we came up with this approach to the project now, that we wanted to map the racism and resistance, because this is something that the African-American community already knew about early in the 20th century. We're very familiar with the, you know, open housing marches in the late 60s, but the Black community, Black Milwaukee, had been protesting, resisting these housing practices way back in the 1920s, if not earlier. So we wanted to tell the whole story. And so that's kind of like how we came together. Yeah. And neither one of us is a, a history, professor. So we've had help from our research team.
So I'm going to cut you off.
Sure.
We're coming back right after the break. Professor Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds will still be here to talk about Mapping Racism and Resistance. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Just really trying to break in.
It makes me smile, and you have a piano, but if you can play the Peanuts theme song.
Oh my gosh.
You know he can.
Yes.
On the Devil's Radio.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. Listen to Max Inc. Radio, Saturday nights, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Hello?
Man, where are you? I thought you were coming.
I can't. I'm in bed with the flu.
The flu? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Grandma's about to crowd surf. Man, I'll call you back.
Don't get stuck at home with the flu. A flu shot is safe, effective, and you can get it at the same time as your COVID-19 vaccine. A flu shot is the best way to prevent the flu and its potentially serious complications. Don't get flu FOMO. Learn more at getmyflushot.org.
Brought to you by the AMA, CDC, and the Ad Council.
Locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. News, talk, and sports from Vesper to Plover. The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
The neighborhood, so keep it down. Art is a storybook, a stubborn
out. To Asquith, Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We are here with Professor Ann Bond and Derek Hanley, and we were talking a little too much with the break, and now we're back. Jane's giving me the eye, and she's like, are you going to talk? But we are talking about the Mapping Racism and Resistance Project that they've started over at UWM. And Professor Hanley, I'll let you finish the point you were talking about before we had to break.
Yes. That's just basically what I was saying is this is how the project came about. And we've been very happy about the reception and people wanting to volunteer and how much they want to be a part of it, because this is a community project, and we've thought of it as such. And so the community is helping us with this project and to tell this larger story.
And so with that, I mean, besides just the fact that you need people power to go through 21,000 documents that is already down from over 1 million documents. But as far as the qualitative benefit, both for the project, but also for the people who are going to volunteer to help go through this, what do you think the value of that is to have so many more people just from the public and not academia be involved?
We've had folks ask this question, you know, with AI software, you know, we could just use AI software and we wouldn't need to do this. And we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
We clearly rely on digital methods in multiple ways on the project. But what we have found and our collaborators is that reading the deeds is incredibly powerful. It's a really important opportunity for us to understand and read and engage with the way that these deeds and this kind of these mechanisms were at work. I think you started out our interview saying, you know, we just kind of understand segregation as kind of just the way it is, or it's just kind of normalized. But, you know, people are very surprised when they see the kind of the ways in which, you know, there's an active role that homeowners, real estate developers, home builders, insurers, that we're all kind of involved in this process. And so it's really revealing for people to really, I think it's powerful for people to learn that their properties have covenants themselves and to kind of reflect and think on that. But it's also just in terms of the community, it's helping us to understand how we got to where we are. So I think there's a really important learning point. And of course, just learning about histories of racism and the way that their legacies continue, in our own urban environments.
And if I just can add, you get insight to the ways in which race was conceptualized in the early 20th century in the language. And we like to prepare folks that you're going to read some things that's very problematic.
Yeah.
And possibly be upsetting, because it's right there. It's one thing to hear that a place is historically segregated. It's another thing to read it and to see it and how matter of fact it was and how it was written into to these deeds. That if a person sold their house to someone who was not of the white race, that they were at risk of losing their home.
Wow.
Forfeiture. So this is what we mean by, you know, when it said it's by design. There was legal consequences if you violated these deeds.
And so when the project, at least the goal, when the project is done, how do you two envision it living on as far as consumption for more people to be able to understand it? Like, do you see it as literally being a map?
Yeah, it will literally be a map, but it will be a digital resource embedded on a website, which right now we just kind of have a placeholder while we're, you know, doing this part of the project. But we'll have a lot of maps. People will be able to search these maps. They'll be able to look up their own properties. So we've done some of the legwork, or we will have at some point in time when these are up. And we also have resources documenting, as Derek said earlier, how Black Milwaukeeans and their allies were challenging these efforts. So we'll have, you know, we'll kind of have this, these kind of interactive maps. And it's also a website that we hope we can collect people's stories. And already we're hearing a lot of stories. People have reached out to us to tell us about their own covenants or their family's experiences being excluded from certain neighborhoods because of their racial identity. And so we want this resource to be a tool, community produced and community, you know, it'll be owned at the university, but at the same time, we want it to be a resource for anybody who wants to go and learn more about this or who needs the information for their own purposes, community groups, city leaders, for anybody.
Yeah. So then last question, are you still looking for volunteers? How many volunteers do you need in total, or what's the hope?
Well, we're about, I think we were just talking about this, a fifth of the way through our 21,000 the documents that we need to read through. So clearly we are still in need of volunteers. You can be a volunteer and just look through one document, as some people are. They do it once and they get the experience and they learn from it. Or you can be a volunteer who does hundreds. And we have some volunteers that are very invested in this and they've been doing it. So we're looking for all levels of support. If people have time and interest, we'll share more information about upcoming. We have both virtual transcription events and then we'll have future in-person events throughout the coming spring and summer until we're done. And I can kind of preview that we'll be releasing some preliminary maps in March. So we'll have some maps up to, because teasers to keep interest alive as we're working through these along the way.
All right. Well, we will put all of the information if you are interested in volunteering, because you don't have to be in Milwaukee, right?
Nope.
You can do it virtually.
Yep. Do it virtually.
Anywhere from the state. We will put
or the
all,
country. We have
country.
People all over the place. Yeah.
There you go.
And can I just add one thing?
Yep.
That each deed has to be verified from five different people. So
that's why we
need so many volunteers. Because we want to verify the language in these deeds. So each deed has to have five different readers of it.
Thank you, Derek. I forgot to mention that.
That is an important distinction. Okay. So if you are interested in this project, we will have all the information of how you can sign up and learn more on our episode blog for today. Professor Ann Bonds, Professor Derek Hanley, thank you so much for making the trip to Waukesha and being here in person today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to take another break and we'll be back in just a minute. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
WAUK 540. Your hometown station for news, talk, and sports. Locally grown radio is 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Thank you for listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Now join us anytime by finding and following our Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram pages. We want to hear from you there, too. You'll also find social media links for your favorite shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
Finish your high school diploma for you and your family. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Thursdays at 11:30, we are joined by Dr. Michael McCutcheon, who is a psychologist, a lecturer, and additionally, he's won 10,000 fantasy football leagues and loves to help people make easy, free money. Dr. Mike fixes your life and your lineup.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Over the Back Fence has moved. Tune in on Saturdays at 11 a.m. for an hour of water cooler talk, items you're looking to buy or sell, upcoming events in central Wisconsin, or just whatever. Join the conversation by calling 715-424-2600, and we'll go over the back fence at its new day and time, Saturdays at 11 a.m., right before the Sunshine Polka Party Show. It's the audio community bulletin board that comes to you. We'll see you there.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. At 4 in the morning, my phone rang. They said, "I regret to inform you that your husband was wounded in action." Victor sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. I was doing school full time, and I was also then caring for Victor. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself. I just didn't want to forget that I also had goals and that I also had a life. What I did is I challenged Victor to meet me halfway. There are almost 6 million military and veteran caregivers across the nation. We have our own journey, and we can fulfill that journey at the same time that we are helping our loved one.
Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Parents, we know we can't protect our kids from everything. Eventually, they're going to bump their heads or scrape their knees. But we can protect them from 6 types of cancer. HPV, or human papillomavirus, is a common, preventable virus that can cause cancer later in life. The HPV vaccine prevents human papillomavirus and all the cancers it can cause. The American Cancer Society recommends getting your sons and daughters the HPV vaccine starting at age 9 to protect them later in life.
For Civic Media, I'm Melissa Kay with your local news update. The Badger Institute commended the flat tax legislation proposed by Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux. They say Lemieux's proposal will be beneficial for almost all businesses. They claim it will produce long-term economic growth and opportunity and benefit all Wisconsinites. Lemieux's proposal would phase in a flat income tax rate of 3.25% by 2026. Governor Tony Evers said he would block the plan as it benefits the wealthy over the middle class. Low and middle income earners would see little to no relief, while the wealthiest earners would see their tax rate cut in half. A Texas brewery is canceling a scheduled rally featuring Kyle Rittenhouse. The Illinois man was acquitted of homicide charges in Wisconsin related to the Kenosha riots of 2020. Officials with Southern Star Brewing say the so-called rally against censorship doesn't reflect their values. Rittenhouse says he's disappointed. And that's the news on your locally grown radio station.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A winter storm watch begins at midnight Thursday morning and continues until 6 p.m. Thursday night. 26 overnight under overcast skies, northwesterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Highs level off around 33, tomorrow cloudy skies. Snow likely, tomorrow night 27, cloudy. 4 to 8 inches of snow tomorrow night through Thursday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 34.
Report titled "A Housing Hurdle: Demographics Drive Need for More Homes." And in that report, on the low end, they said that the state needs to build at least 140,000 housing units by 2030 to keep up with demand. And so I was fascinated with this because I think whether we're talking about Madison zoning, we're talking about condos, but I know in Green Bay, like everywhere around the state, affordable housing is an issue. And yet it's also coupled with, and doesn't see, it seems conflicting in when we talk about population and in everywhere but Dane County having a declining working age population. And so here to help us kind of make sense of all of this is Mr. Dale Knapp. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here today.
So let's just start from the beginning, because I think sometimes like needing the definition or starting with a definition is important. So when we talk about affordable housing, what does that actually mean?
Well, first, let me go back even one step before that. So for this report, and people ask us that when we're talking about housing, so people oftentimes just think single family homes, but this we're talking in, you know, in terms of need, this is a combination of single family homes, condominiums, apartments, you know, sort of the whole gamut. So we're not just talking single family homes. When we're talking about affordable housing, and we got into that a little bit, but affordable housing typically is defined housing in which your housing costs are under 30% of your income. That's generally what's considered affordable.
And because I think sometimes people, when they hear affordable housing, they think of like Section 8 of like low income housing. And those are two different things, right?
Two different things, definitely. Yes.
And so what this report looked at is the decline or the lack of supply of housing that's available for people who, and that falls in their income being, or that falls under the cost being less than 30% of their income. And which makes a lot of sense, because I feel like anecdotally, mortgages are going up, especially with interest rates going up. And so what are some of the causes that got us here? Because I don't think it's just one thing. And so what did you find in this report of like how we got to this point?
Yeah, so one of the things, the big driver of this is really demographics. You know, we did a report in the fall looking at the state's workforce and workforce age population. And we're on a path to, by 2030, have 130,000 fewer 25 to 64 year olds in the state. That's the prime working age population. And so when we put that out, one of the questions we got from a lot of people was, well, that's going to really make the housing shortages and housing affordability, you know, that's going to, you know, make housing more affordable because we're not going to have the demand we did. And they forgot that, yes, there's this big baby boom generation leaving the workforce, but they're going to stay in, like generations past, they're going to stay in their homes for, you know, another 10, 15, 20 years. And so even though that prime workforce population is going to shrink, unless we do something about it, we're still going to need to build, you know, 140,000 housing units just to have homes for the young people that'll be coming into the workforce. So that's that's not even considering affordability. So that's just the number that we're going to need. Now, when you talk about affordable housing, that's where the whole supply and demand comes in. And one of the things that's been, you know, driving the inaffordability to some degree, you know, is, again, it goes back to the baby boom generation. You know, they're moving often when they retire to be near their kids. And so, you know, they're coming into places and driving up home prices. And that, you know, makes it unaffordable in some cases for young people. Now, you mentioned the interest rate issue. That's more recent.
Yeah.
And that's causing a, you know, that's really putting a lot of housing out of reach for a lot of young people, just because, you know, you're looking at a housing payment that may have doubled compared to 2 years ago, what it would have been.
So then, because on the high end, I think the minimum for the report found is 140,000 units.
Yeah.
The high end was like 227,000, right?
Yeah. So
go ahead.
No, so that's, and that's, you know, because again, as I just said, this 140 is really the minimum that we need. If we're happy that our prime working age population is going to decline by 130,000. We're not going to do anything about it. That's what we need. But that workforce problem is going to create all kinds of yes. problems throughout the economy. And so we have to do something about that. And the only way to do that is through migration. You know, having more kids, it's going to take 20 years to yeah. create a worker out of that, the new kids. So you have to have housing for them. So to completely solve that problem adds another 50, 60, 70,000 housing units in terms of need. And then we have a third component, which really goes to the affordable housing. The number of young people, young adults under age 35, that are living at home, probably temporarily, you know, just out of college, et cetera, has gone up significantly over the last decade, both here and nationally. And the primary driver of that is the lack of affordable housing. They can't find housing that fits within their budget, given their incomes. And that's a problem that again, that needs to be solved. And that adds another 20,000 housing units. So if we want to try to solve kind of all of our problems, you're getting up to 227,000 housing units. And, you know, a big, big chunk of those have to be affordable housing. They can't be the, you know, if it's a single family home, you know, it can't be the $400,000, $500,000 home. It's got to be something that's affordable. So it's this dual challenge here, really.
And so, and I asked this when we were talking about condos, and maybe condos and the thing that what it was talked about in Milwaukee is a different issue, but it seems like kind of the bigger question is the same of like, who's responsible for building affordable housing? Like, whose charter is it to start to address this problem? And, you know, for the developers, as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece said, when specifically talking about condos, is it's more profitable to make apartments versus condos. But like even for duplexes or condos or single family homes. And so if we need to be building more, who's responsible for building and making sure that what they're building can be in that lower range so people can afford to buy them?
Sure. I mean, really, a lot of it goes to municipal officials.
Okay.
For a couple of reasons. You know, one is before we can even build homes, they have to be creating lots, creating subdivisions, et cetera. And that's one of the challenges that we faced over the last decade is we haven't created enough lots to meet the demand. And that's been helping to drive up prices. But then, you know, part of this is the size of the lot. A lot of places, a lot of communities like larger lots we're seeing, and thus larger homes, that makes them less affordable. And sometimes there's a lot of restrictions in terms of building that drive up costs. So there is that on the municipal side. And then the builder side, they generally make more money off of building bigger homes. So there's clearly a desire to do that. And given lumber prices, given labor shortages, and so wages for carpenters, et cetera, going up, you know, it's a challenge to build. If you're talking about single family homes, it's a challenge to build, you know, a new home, you know, that's of some decent size. You know, maybe it's, you know, 1,500 square feet. That seems like an affordable price. It's the economics of it are really challenging. And generally then they don't make as much money off of that. So it's not blame, but there's a lot of competing forces out there. And you know, the other thing is when you have communities now that for years have had homes that are of a certain size or whatever, oftentimes when municipalities look to bring in apartment buildings, et cetera, it's not generally the local officials that are opposed to it. They're looking to do that, but their constituents often don't want the apartments there. And so, you know, they put pressure on the local officials, you know, not to approve those kinds of things. And that's a challenge in a lot of places.
And I want to get to that next. But we're talking to Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. And is... Not that this is your opinion, but as far as in your research, why do homeowners typically... Is there any data that points to an apartment unit in a neighborhood decreasing home value? That there is kind of this NIMBYism when it comes to either zoning or apartment buildings or mixed use and having duplexes and stuff. So, like, what is the, as you said, less than the local officials, but more of the constituents who don't want that? What reasoning, what well-founded reasoning do they have to not want that?
Well, in terms of the residents that are in the immediate vicinity, what you're talking about is often, a relatively large amount of traffic coming from, because the apartment building is there compared to single family homes. So, that's one of the reasons, and there's a variety of reasons, but, the home values, there's so many factors that go into home values. And, you can look at home values in general would go up if you have more young people in the community who ultimately will be home buyers and will drive up demand for single family homes. Almost everybody started in an apartment. That's important. And in Wisconsin, the way we fund schools, et cetera, you want to have those young people here with young families. Often they're starting out in apartments. But that helps drive the funding of your schools, and you get better schools, and that drives up home prices. So it can work in a couple of different ways. But I think it's the traffic issues for the people that are immediately there in the area. That's one of the driving factors.
And then my last question, Dale, is in your research for this paper, this report, is there any communities in Wisconsin that are making headway or starting to address this problem successfully?
There's two counties in Wisconsin there's a lot of communities that are trying to figure this out, and they're approaching it different ways. Surprisingly, there's two counties that are already doing something, putting together programs. Washington County and Sheboygan County are working, putting money towards and trying to figure out how to ensure that there's affordable housing in their communities. And normally the counties don't get involved with this, but they're doing some innovative things, and started by looking at what's driving the affordability problem, and they're at the beginning of that process, but they're I think moving in the right direction. I think we'll see more counties sort of get involved in that.
All right. Well, Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association, thank you so much for joining us today. We will link the report, A Housing Hurdle, Demographics Drive, Need for More Homes, on today's episode blog. But thank you so much for spending time with us and trying to demystify this issue.
It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. All right. Well, we're going to take another break. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which was audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
My name is Juanita Segura, and I was diagnosed in November of 2014 with non-small cell lung cancer. The first time I heard about biomarker testing was actually my husband. He just started researching about lung cancer.
And I found out about biomarker testing, and I'm like, why not? Let's try it.
I'm Dr. Jorge Gomez, thoracic medical oncologist at the Mount Sinai Hospital. Comprehensive biomarker testing is looking for either substances in the blood or mutations in some of the genes of the cancer cells that can help us identify special types of lung cancer that can be treated with what we call targeted therapies.
Letting my children know brought all of us a sense of hope, to give them hope that mom is going to be around to see you grow up. And I promised them that.
Ask your doctor about how comprehensive biomarker testing before treatment may help you and your doctor decide on the best treatment for you. Visit noonemissed.org for more.
A public service message from Longevity Foundation.
Don't search through the phone book for hours looking for help. Don't waste time being transferred from department to department looking for answers. United Way's 211 is there to connect you to the programs and services you need. For non-emergency information and referral services, simply dial 211 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Free and confidential information and referral is available throughout central Wisconsin. Dial 211 and get connected and get answers.
From Lake Wazeecha and beyond, your news, talk, and sports is locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Network. A reminder that we love hearing from you. If you have a topic that we should cover or a guest that we should have on, let us know. We likely will follow through on that. And also, if you missed this announcement earlier, we are giving away free ad space. Yes, no catch. Don't tell me that there's no such thing as a free lunch, because the Civic Media Network, in our growing stations across Wisconsin, means that we have ad space that we want to use to bolster and lift up small businesses across Wisconsin. And so how does this work? What does this actually mean? So on January 26th.
It's a Thursday.
Thursday at 9 a.m., civicmedia.us applications will be open. You have to fill out a couple questions, and then you will work with the Civic Media sales team to develop your radio promo and what that would sound like on air. And literally, it's free ad space. So you get to promote your business for free. And so there's no reason you should not do this.
There's an important caveat, though.
There is an important caveat. So if you're going to do it, I need you to do one important thing. It's maybe the most important thing when you're doing the application. Which is to say that Jane and Kristen on As Goes Wisconsin sent you. That's very, very important, because it's not really a competition. Like, I don't think we're going to win anything beyond bragging rights.
It's about bragging rights.
But it really is about bragging rights. And we've already discussed that I come from a very competitive family. I'm a very competitive person. And so when you go on Thursday, January 26th to civicmedia.us on the $1 million ad giveaway, fill out all your information. But make sure you tell them As Goes Wisconsin sent you.
We were the ones. Yes.
So just to wrap up our conversation around housing, was that a lot? Was that too much housing for one show?
It was so informative. It really was.
It really, I mean, it's so interesting, because it's something that we all need. And, you know, there's a conversation around housing being a human right, and especially affordable housing and the different markets and how market forces are changing and everything. But it's also complicated. And so trying to understand the moving habits and the working habits and the transit habits and how all of this is connected. And so having people who are, you know, obviously looking backwards at certain ways of how we got here, and then looking forward towards the next decade of how we're going to manage all of this. And so I think having these conversations, and also I think when we talk about the residents, constituents, homeowners who have, you know, trepidation towards new developments, considering, like, it kind of just comes back to, I don't know, it comes back to being, I think, a collectivist and thinking, like, what is best for the community? Because if you're not going to embrace more affordable housing, don't turn around and complain about homeless population increasing. You know, and some of the negative externalities when there's not places for people to live, what that leads to.
Well, and what Dale shared with us, I think the most hopeful thing was that we have some counties now that are getting involved and trying to come up with some plans, because I can see it in my own little neighborhood.
Really?
Well, there's one little house, and it's little. I mean, teeny little. Like, the kitchen is so small, you can't put a kitchen table in it.
Oh, you've seen this house?
I've seen
the
house.
You've been inside, okay.
Yep. And it sold last year for $265,000.
Oh, wow.
And
probably not that long ago, it was under $100,000.
Or at least $150,000.
Yeah.
And how is that going to be sustainable?
Yeah.
If the current owner can't sell it for $280,000 or $290,000 or $300,000, I just don't see, again, how this is sustainable unless we're all going to become programmers
making that $900,000.
Making $900,000. Yeah, well, yeah. Or the head of We Energies and make $12 million a year. That's
how much the We Energies CEO makes?
I don't know about the current one, but I'm fairly certain that for previous CEOs, yes. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Pretty good job.
Good work if you can get it.
Exactly. Even if you only do it for a year.
Yeah, seriously. Well, one thing we could all do is just, even if you're not in a, you know, marriage or in a relationship, maybe you could buy a house with some friends or a sibling, because that is a growing, not phenomenon, a growing trend. A recent Zillow survey shows that co-buying or purchasing a home with someone you're not in a romantic relationship with is incredibly common. 18% of recent home buyers purchased with a relative or friend. About 1 in 5 up-and-coming buyers said they intend to.
Wow.
And this is according to the Housing Innovation Collaborative. And so would you, I feel like I see jokes and memes every once in a while, especially for women, of like running off and starting your own commune with all your friends and like owning property, and we can all raise each other's kids and kind of this idealist fantasy of what that could look like. But like, would you actually, is there a friend that you feel like you're like, I would buy a home with them? Because it's one thing, because a roommate situation, you can always, there's less skin in the game.
Right. I love my girlfriends so much, and they save my life every day. And no, I couldn't live with any of them. I could probably do that with one of my sisters.
Why your sister? Is it just because you can fight differently with your sisters because they're family than
I think
your
we
friends?
Can, because you can be a little blunter, maybe. And we're family. I don't know. Not all of my siblings. Trust me, I couldn't live with all of my siblings. And they would say the same thing about me.
Not even live with. Co-own something.
Oh, no. And you have to be so careful if you do that. Money does twitchy things to people.
Well, that's why it's interesting. I mean, money does twitchy things in marriages, right?
Yes.
Like the number one reason like listed for divorce is usually money issues and talking about money and different relationships with money. And it's almost the same thing as when you, the advice of don't go into business with family or friends.
Right.
Because if you approach the business differently and you have different ideas and there's butting of heads, that what seemed like a good idea in the beginning and only looking at the upside can end relationships.
Absolutely.
Because what do you do in a situation of, like, what is legally do you get to? Because in a divorce, obviously, there's an end of that relationship. And so, like, the courts get involved as far as breaking up the house.
You got to have some kind of contract.
Yeah. So,
And the other thing to live by, don't loan anyone money if you can't afford not to get it back.
Advice from Jane Matinair. All right. Well, we're going to take another break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, moving on from the housing conversation, let's talk about some Packers. Mr. Aaron Nagler from Cheesehead TV. We started the season with him. We're going to end the season with him. He's going to be here to tell us what he would do if he were the GM of the Packers. And then it's National Bootlegger Day. So I thought we'd revisit the conversation around how Prohibition really bolstered the Packers 100 years ago. All right, this is As Goes Wisconsin.
Let's face it, life looks a little different. During these times, we're doing our best to keep our minds and bodies strong. And getting a flu shot helps us stay healthy, so we don't miss out on what matters. Like having game night at home. Yeah, can't do that while sick with the flu. Now imagine family movie night that your daughter can't live without. Well, that's ruined. And don't forget your uncle's socially distanced cookout. See? That's why it's important to be at our strongest. Every year, millions of people in the U.S. get the flu. Especially now, no one has time to miss out on moments that matter. So get your flu shot. Find out more at getmyflushot.org. Brought to you by the AMA, CDC, and
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248 DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
Stop surfing the dial.